One, two, three, four.
We narrate the story of our lives to ourselves. We narrate it in linear fashion. And I know many writers have played with time in all sorts of amazing ways, but we're storytellers. This is what we do. And if you give the brain a story, a pre-packaged story, you're giving it cheesecake. That's what it wants. That's why it loves stories. That's why our society is just built on stories. Politics is nothing but stories. Everything we do in the evenings, we sit down, we're watching Netflix, just stories. We consume them all the time. We're just machines for belief.
Paul Lynch is the author of 5 novels. His most recent novel, Prophet Song, won the 2023 Booker Prize, the Dayton Literary Peace Prize for Fiction, and other prizes. Prophet Song presents a dystopian vision of Ireland and a mother's determination to protect her family as her country slides towards totalitarianism. The Booker Prize jury said, "It's a remarkable accomplishment for a novelist to capture the social and political anxieties of our moment so compellingly." In 2024, Lynch was elected to Ashtana, the Irish Academy for the Arts, honouring distinguished artists. He was formerly the chief film critic of Ireland's Sunday Tribune newspaper, and his novels have been translated into 35 languages. Paul Lynch, welcome to The Creative Process.
It's great to be here. Thank you, Mia.
So we're here to discuss your creativity, which now spans several books. And I'm wondering how much you feel where you were born has inspired you creatively. And just for those who don't know, you were born in Limerick, raised in Donegal. You now live in Dublin. Limerick and Dublin were garrison towns. And we know the occupation of Limerick and Dublin feels like it might have wound its way into Prophet Song. And as I go back over your series of books, often set in the past, often people, you know, facing very difficult circumstances, but finding beauty and resilience. There's poetry that helps them rise above it or also even shields them from the pain of those experiences. And, you know, so just take us back to your roots when you discovered you were a writer, your literary heritage, and what awakened that within you.
Well, if you're looking for a source of the central tension in my novels, you're not going to find it in Dublin or Limerick. I think that the things that I channel for my fiction are very deep universal energies that I'm seeking. You know, I was a kid who grew up in a very rural Donegal, which is the north of Ireland, not Northern Ireland, but the very far north. I grew up in a place called Malmhead initially, which is the most northerly point in Ireland, which was metaphysically interesting. It's just wind and rain and sea and
listen,
mountains.
I know it well. I'm a painter and I traveled the whole coast. I lived in Ireland for many years and traveled the coast. I know it. You go on those roads and you feel like, you know, but for the road, has anyone been here before? Yeah.
Yeah, you're definitely back in time. And there is that sense always when you're up there, certainly as a writer, of not just the time you're in now, but the time always, the deep geological time that these places suggest. And so there's something about growing up in a place like that. I did grow up in a town called Carndonagh further south later on, but there's something about the imprinting of that on the psyche, that sense of the inalienable, barren universe that we're in, which we often forget because we're so distracted by modern life and so distracted also by the layers that we add on top of just the busy lives through our phones and technology, that there's this world around us, you know? There's the sky, there's the clouds. I love watching clouds. And this was my childhood. And it was later when I went back to set my first few novels in Donegal, I realized that that sense of deep time could be used to evoke something that I'm searching for in my fiction, which is, I suppose you could say, a sense of the cosmic, a sense of the human condition throughout time, a sense of what it is that makes human beings always, and not just the moment that we're in now. But also the central problem of being people, of being human beings, is we're here on this earth for just this brief, white-hot moment, and the world around us is silent and doesn't give a damn. And so those kind of ideas are working quietly in the background of my books.
Yeah, I'm telling students that all the time, too, that we're here about, 27,000 days, if we're lucky. And what do you do with this life? And I do wonder about that, because often your fiction is preoccupied with travelers or sense of exile or being on the sea or traveling across the sea. And I know that your dad was what some might call a kind of Coast Guard, mariner first.
He was a mariner. He was an officer at sea and then came back home to be a Coast Guard, yeah.
And so I wondered what you were like as a young boy, or imagining him, what he was doing on the seas, and the sense of wonder, like the mystery in looking out in Donegal and going to the sea, and just the beyondness of it. It really sparks the imagination.
Yeah, I mean, every writer has their own personal mythology, don't they? It's really important what goes into the plot as a kid is what helps to cook the fiction later on. And in my case, my father had been at sea throughout his 20s and all over the world. And I remember there was two things that excited me in the bedroom, in his mess, in the cabinet. The wardrobe, very top part, you'd open it up and it'd be stacked full of thrillers. So he'd all these, you know, just books that I was too young to read. I wasn't allowed to read Len Dighton novels and cheap airport thrillers and stuff, but a stack of passports and quite a stack. Back in the time when every time you crossed the border, you got the stamp. It's not the case anymore, but I used to just sit with that stack of passports and it fueled the imagination that there is this world out there far beyond the very small confines of Donegal, that there's the world waiting. And as soon as I came of age, I went backpacking as well and saw as many far-flung places as I could. So these things are very powerful for the imagination. And when you're traveling like that yourself, you're stocking the imagination with sights, with people, with things you see that sneak into the fiction later. And then there's also what my father, his own stories, his own personal mythology, has handed down to me and my brother and sister, what he experienced on the Pacific Ocean many times. Living through shipwrecking typhoons, making it back to Tokyo with one pump working on an enormous freighter that could very easily have gone down, you know, spending 13 months at one point without leaving the ship, sailing around the Pacific. Just these sort of stories, they go in very deep. And I wrote Beyond the Sea, leaning into that sense of the mythic that I grew up with.
Yeah. And that's just, you know, pared down storytelling to like 2 men at sea. And I think it's interesting to hear that, you know, you've heard those stories from your father, but also to have a sense of, oh, he had this life before. I think when we're children, sometimes we don't have that sense, like the whole world revolves around us. But then you have the evidence, you have the passports, you know, all the stamps and the countries. So that already sets up this storytelling engine in your mind. I think, well, what was my dad before? I mean, he's not just my dad, right? And I think that that's a great gift to give this curiosity. I know also for the children of immigrants often too, that's the thing, like a lot of things aren't said, right? Immigrants or refugees, but knowing that there's this veil of silence or there's something that you couldn't be a part of. I'm just intuiting.
Yeah, we're talking about the door to wonder here, you know? Anything that opens that door to wonder is what takes us into the deeper level of what if and what could be and what was. And that's the first questions of storytelling.
Yeah, you're in Dublin now. I'm in Paris, and I know that France has long loved your writing. I think maybe you got known and loved in France before Ireland, if I may say. It's a weird thing that France has about picking people from different parts of the world and celebrating them. Of course, your writing is now celebrated all over the world. What do you think it is about your writing that resonates in France or in different parts of the world as you've traveled and spoken with people?
I'm hardly the first Irish writer to be recognized in France before being recognized in her homeland. It's not an uncommon thing. I think if I'm to venture here, what the French saw in my writing was what was new about it, was the writers that I was putting together, sort of pushing together to form the Paul Lynch Project, whose perhaps two different traditions clashing, which was the fiction of Faulkner, McCarthy, O'Connor from the Southern Gothic, that sort of dense, stylistic, Gnostic fiction of dark and cosmic themes. And at the same time, then a more lyrical tradition coming out of Ireland and writers like Heaney and Yeats, and that ability for there to be an intense kind of beauty to the sentence and richness too. I was working from both of those pools and coming up with my own work, but the French immediately articulated it. They spotted what it was. And, you know, I think early on they started saying that I was the heir to Faulkner and McCarthy, which I thought was kind of a ridiculous claim. I still kind of do. But, you know, my career took off there first, and there was definitely traction in America, but it wasn't huge. Absolutely nothing in the UK, just nothing. But that's the road. You never know when you write fiction, when you publish books, You just don't know where you're going to find your audience and who, you know, how people are going to read you. Also, I think to a large degree, I was misunderstood. That's not a bad thing. We all know Emerson's great line about being misunderstood. But the kind of fiction that I was pushing is a tradition that's maybe not recognized all that much. And I wrote an essay about this last year, and I call it cosmic fiction. When I say cosmic, I'm referring to writers such as Melville, Dostoevsky, Conrad, Faulkner, many others, but writers who are really crafting fiction as though it's a cosmic eye in the sky, as though looking from a great distance, what we are as human beings always, what is the human condition? But at the same time, it's fiction that has the ability to get down to the furniture in the room, to describe the texture of the wood on the table, to describe human beings in extraordinary detail, and to have that sense of scalability, to have that sense of the absolute within reach always, that sense of the cosmos, that sense of the human condition, of our alienation, of our just our position in this vast universe, while at the same time, you know, the heat of life and the wants and desires and needs and the foolish aspirations and the emotions that tangle us up and all of these things, and to get them down into the one place. And so this kind of fiction always has within reach a sense of the infinite. And I think it is a tradition. I don't think it's been articulated properly by anybody, but I'm trying to articulate it. I think it's something very specific. And so that's what I fit into. And that's just what comes out. It's what I am. But I think that was misunderstood, definitely, especially the early reviewers in Ireland just did not understand what I was doing.
Yeah, so you mentioned a few things there, a sense of the cosmic, of the universe. You know, on the one hand, authors who have a kind of Gnostic tradition and others for whom language is almost an article of faith. And well, you were born into Catholic Ireland, but I don't know if you're Catholic. You mentioned before we started recording that you meditated this morning. So what role does a sense of the spiritual play with that? Or how do you find its echoes within you?
It's a good question. I have no faith. I belong to a generation that's come out of what could be described as theocratic Ireland. You know, the Catholic Church had an incredibly strong vice-like grip on this country, and it was insufferable. And the grip was to such an extent that, you know, Freud once joked that the Irish are the only nation impervious to psychoanalysis. And I often wondered what he meant until I realized, well, you go to psychoanalysis to have whatever shame you're grappling with internally, to have it taken out of you. But you can't have the shame taken out of you if the shame is actually structural, if it's what society is built out of. And that's what the church did to Ireland. So I belong to what you might call post-Catholic Ireland now. But the question of the spiritual is very interesting. I have no faith, but I view the word spiritual in a very different kind of way. I don't view it in a religious sense, but I do think that there's a very important aspect of self to be recognized, which is our place within the cosmos, within the world that we're in. Not everything is political, unfortunately, though we live in a time where our society believes that everything can be solved by and within society. And this is a really dangerous thought because it's just not true. And when Robinson Crusoe washed up on that desert island and found himself confronting himself within the empty world that he was in, he was confronting himself, his God and his cosmos. And that's a very private conversation that everybody needs to have. And so our relationship to life, our relationship to the moment that we're in, our relationship to the unfolding moment are all very important things. These things have always been religious ideas, but they're also not religious ideas. You know, you can call them spiritual if you like. They're a huge part of my writing. I think that locating the reader in the moment of unfolding is something that I try to do. I write in the present tense. I'm very interested in the texture of life, the feeling of life, the heartbeat of life, and also at the same time, the alienation that one feels every moment in life, the unknowing, the sense of being up against the what next. You know, when you write in the past tense, which is the default mode of fiction, something has been lost that I think is found when you write in the present tense. And obviously, I think the present tense is something that borrowed heavily from cinema, but Dickens did it. There are other writers wrote in the present tense before the domination of film. But something within the present tense that I love very much is how you can create that feeling of the unknown, of our alienation right in this very moment, of just not knowing. that life is darkness. Life is what Virginia Woolf called that small flame in the dark. We move through life step by step with just this small matchlight, casting this small bit of light. And the rest is unknowing. That's how it is. And so that's a very metaphysical thing. And so for my sentences, you know, whether you want to call it metaphysical or spiritual or whatever, there is that sense of pushing into the moment, pushing into the known, but also pushing into the unknown, taking the reader right up to the edge of that, because the character lives on the edge of that. And when you do that, you take the reader into that moment with the character. So the reader begins to feel entirely alongside that character, entirely in step with that character.
I think that that's true. I think that the moment it's put into past tense, already there's that remove, as though we ever have that much knowledge of ourselves. So something already is kind of died for you to talk about it in the past tense. And the spoken word is of the present tense, usually, you know, we're not talking in a past tense with that distance. It's interesting talking about Ireland and, you know, at one time it was and still is, has the resonance of being a very religious country. And yet at the same time, in my experience, it's also with a kind of paganism, like they believe so strongly, but also almost don't believe in anything. Like if it's a choice between meaning and music, they'll go with music often, as long as it sounds right. The Irish have made English their own through this Hiberno English, also known as Irish English. When I think about faith and Ireland, I think it's as much about the theater of it. It's not one of pure belief, but maybe I have that wrong, but that is my feeling. I find it liberating. And I think for people, when they visit Ireland, you know, they talk about the warm welcome and all that, but it's also this kind of familiarity or this kind of mix of high and low or lack of reverence for things that is interesting. And I think now we've had the Celtic Tiger, in a way might be vanishing. I remember, and you lived through this too, with the Celtic Tiger, I could see it changing. Could see these talk about there being characters and having this particular way of speaking and going around where the publican could be a kind of, you know, like a bard, and this art of storytelling was very alive. And then it became about money. And so I have a certain sense of nostalgia about that. I know it's not totally vanished, but it has changed a lot in these last decades. And I wonder what your reflections are of that. What are we losing? What should we hold on to? And how does that change literature? The injection of money and less of these characters that I see walking around.
There is very definitely an extraordinary richness to the language. And one of the reasons for that is that the country spoke Irish largely before it spoke English. And so grammatically, the structure of Irish is different to English. And so what happened was, as Ireland adopted the English language, this sort of hybridization started to occur where the language was placed on top of Irish grammatical constructions. So you get this slipperiness, this ability to place sentences, to move them around, to place words in interesting places, and to use different constructions that you just wouldn't find in England. I'll give you an interesting example. This is some years ago. I was walking along the road where I live, and I heard two people talking, two local working class people. And this fella's walking up, and he stopped by this younger lady, and she says to him, "Were you lashing the sunbeds out of it? Were you lashing the sunbeds out of it?"
Okay.
By which she means, have you been using the sunbeds too much?
You're lashing yourself and with sunbeds.
Out of it means too much. And it's such a unique combination of such a unique flavor of words. The thing about being an Irish writer is there is an irreverence. There is sort of a sense of implicit freedom that we can use the language whichever way we like. So long as you have mastery and command of the language, you can push it to the edges. And we've got writers who've done that, of course. I mean, Joyce would be the end point of that. A writer like Joyce is a writer of the scale of Shakespeare. And so a writer at that level transmits energy into the culture and they change the language. Yeah. And they transmit just this sense of freedom to try things. I would hazard that English writers, for example, just might not feel as free to do so. They might feel a more greater responsibility with the language. But Irish writers, I mean, we just take brazen risks, but the risks that I see are always in pursuit of truth. And the project, as I see it, is always to try and seize hold of reality in some way. And reality isn't just what you see. It can be internal. It can be dream. It can be the full depths of human experience, which can include the Gnostic. And so you have to push language into spaces and places and you have to bend it and you have to break it to articulate or get across the feelings of things that otherwise might be beyond description. And so it's a great benefit to the Irish in that regard. You know, I just had the thought there, of course, that Shakespeare did that better than anybody, and he was English, so I don't know, has something gone wrong there? But as regards Irish writing now and, you know, the Ireland that we're in, I mean, what's happened is Irish society has secularized at a speed that's almost unprecedented. In the space of a decade, we've gone through 30, 40 years of what took Europe to achieve. And if you read Annie Ernaux's The Years, you see the trajectory that France went along. We did that in 10 years.
Yeah.
And it's going to be interesting to see where the country goes. But what's happened is we've become very global.
Mm-hmm.
We've become citizens of the world. We're at this nexus point of between America, between Europe, as a sort of leading English-speaking country. We've got a lot of tech here. And so we're also experiencing this sort of social revolution as a, you know, post-Catholic country, so to speak. And there is still Catholicism here, of course. It's just not as strong as it used to be, and it doesn't control the politics anymore. And so we're figuring out who we are now. It's a very interesting time. This energy that's coming out of Irish fiction, I believe, is directly related to this situation. Who are we now as Irish citizens? What does it mean to be an Irish person at this moment in time, at this particular nexus point of modernity and history and all these tectonic shifts that are occurring? And so it provides energy to fiction. And if you look at a book like Prophet Song, it's, you know, to a non-Irish person, it's a distinctly Irish novel in terms of its setting and its characters. But at the same time, it's a completely global novel. What animates that book are energies that are global and perhaps timeless. And so I'm just coming out of the milieu that I'm in, the time that I'm in, like everybody else.
Yeah, no, that's so interesting, yes, because Prophet Song has that mythic element, the very personal element, the political, but it's shadowy, you know, living in this kind of fascist police thing. So it's very interesting that it calls upon the reader's imagination a lot. I also want to go back to that thing you said about Joyce and talking about you pushing language and pushing to find out what lies underneath, you know, meaning and music again, because I remember Joyce was a tenor. He really had potential to have a career as a tenor, and then he became a writer. And so he could draw upon that musicality. And I think that also we mustn't forget Prophet Song is a song, right? And the way it's organized, the way it's written without the breaks, we have to interpret it. Like Joyce too, we have to interpret it. We have to bring to that our own internal music. I think you have to be a good reader. It's a lyrical journey. What made you decide on that kind of breathless quality, if you would characterize it as that?
Well, in the novel, what's unfolding is inescapable. And that's a very important quality to try and locate within the reader themselves, this feeling that what's unfolding is inevitable. It's like a riptide that's pulling you out to sea. And it's something that Eilish is going to fight against, she's going to struggle against. But it's the feeling of the time that you're in. Rather, you know, as I mentioned earlier, rather than writing in the past tense, it's an event that's already happened. And this is a story that's been told in the now. It's a story that's designed to create the feeling of imprisonment in the moment as it happens. And so Eilish is waking up to a world where what she took for granted all her life, the known world of life in a liberal democracy. So, you know, there is that sense of life as you knew it, life in a liberal democracy that you believe is going to continue always, actually may not continue always, that actually you're watching the unraveling of it. But it's the recognition of the unraveling. It's very hard to do. We even have it in our own moment now. There's definitely an unraveling occurring, but how many of us are able to recognize it? And worse, what are we able to do about it? So that sense of powerlessness that one feels, that sense of being alienated from the moment that you're in, that sense of being caught up in an unknowing, this is part of why Prophet Song is structured the way it is, that you're locked into these block paragraphs. There's no room to breathe. There's no white space, because what Eilish is experiencing is claustrophobic.
Yeah, we're experiencing this to the extent that she is. But I mean, it does seem like these last few years is a kind of continuous horror from the rise in populism in different countries in Europe and, of course, in America. And I just didn't know that we would ever live through this again. I thought that that was for history, you know, now coming up at 100 years of the rise of fascism in Germany. And here we go around again.
Yeah, unfortunately, it seems to be that this particular energy is not new. It's a timeless energy. I think it's a very dangerous thing to narrow fascism down to something that belongs to the 20th century, or even to say that it's a modern phenomenon. I think that fascism is a very ancient phenomenon that is just dressed in the clothes of the 20th century. I think what we're talking about here are evolutionary drives that are built into us. Tribalism is an instinct. And I think that when human beings have a sense of serious scarcity or threat, they default to behaviors that are unthinkable, and it lies in the shadow within all of us, unfortunately. And the particular moment that we're in seems to have something unique in that technology is fueling this to an extraordinary extent. It's tapping into the particular weaknesses that we have as people, you know, our fears, our anxieties, it's stoking outrage, it's stoking anger. It's driving these forces. And unfortunately, it's very obvious that there are malign actors behind this who are willingly trying to undermine our democracies. And so it's happening at an extraordinary speed. My sense is throughout history, when you look at these particular energies unfolding, it usually leads to a catharsis of some kind, doesn't it? And catharsis is war.
Yeah. And you mentioned Ireland changing a lot over the last few decades, or even within a decade. And I remember when I first came to Ireland, it being nearly all white country. And now we see the amount of immigrants that have come into Ireland, and it being such a small country at the same time. So it's a significant amount of the population. And I don't know what it's like in Donegal, but I remember going around Donegal, and that would be just almost entirely white. You really wouldn't see anyone who looked like me, you know, half Asian looking person. And then that started to change. So I can understand this sense of, oh, we had 700 years of occupation, and then just coming into your identity, into your independence, and just reclaiming a sense of identity on the one hand, but how to do that in a way that respects human rights. And it also welcomes people who have, you know, you talk about having inspiration from Syrian refugees with Prophet Song, having different elements that you drew inspiration from. So I've always known Irish people to be very welcoming. And yet when you do have those levels of immigration, people do circle around the wagons or try to protect their sense of identity.
Yeah, I mean, the right is taking shape in Ireland, but it's nothing like what you see on continental Europe at this point. It remains relatively weak. And the vast majority of Irish people are very welcoming and very understanding of our obligations as a first world European country to those who need to be taken in as a result of war. And we have many Ukrainians in the country now, and we have many others. And unfortunately, the problem is that structurally, we have a major housing shortage in this country. And it's causing problems. It's causing tension in that regard, I think. But the vast majority of people genuinely see themselves as welcoming and see themselves as having a role to play. The country is very small. But at the same time, we also have a vast amount of uninhabited land and a lot of uninhabited buildings that need to be retrofitted or made habitable. And that hasn't happened.
Okay, Henny, would you like to dive in?
Oh, yes. So, hi, I'm Henny. I'm a university student in Chicago. And I'm a poet. I used to write fiction, but I've since gone off that path. But many strains of thought in your work felt highly relevant to things I'm trying to do. I think what I'm most interested after hearing you speak for so long is you mentioned growing up in Ireland where your surroundings were imprinted by deeper time. And Mia was also talking about the reception of your work in different countries. And I was thinking about how traces of time distribute themselves differently in different countries or just different regions. Like they're sedimented and they're formed and they kind of hold their form differently through time. And you also say that Ireland went through a lot of changes in a very short period of time compared to the UK, for example. And so when you walk in Ireland versus Britain, I imagine you can kind of see these traces of time, and not just geologic time, but also human time. I imagine you can see them kind of deposited differently. An example of this is America and the UK, and how for a much younger country, you just don't see as many traces of deeper time around you. And that kind of depth of time kind of bleed into the literature. And so I wanted to ask you about a regional tradition of cosmic history pulling apart the language of local history so that it expands to contain the world and the cosmos. But I'm thinking, like, to what extent must that return to the local? To what extent is the cosmic channels or cosmic feelings you're trying to reach towards still essentially grounded in the local traces of time from which you began?
I can only answer for how I write.
Yes, of course.
I don't think about layers of time in the sense of there is very specifically, you know, when you visit the US, for example, you don't have the kind of sense of lived history that you'll see on the streets of a European city. But even most European cities, you just feel what you're experiencing is a few centuries. You need to go to Rome to get a sense of a couple of thousand years layered against the present moment. But in terms of the cosmic and the personal, it always begins with, for me, a personal problem. It always begins somebody located in space and time with real human problems, somebody who's seeking after something that just, some problem that needs to be resolved. It's not just a simple problem. It's something that I've been mulling over probably for years. It's something that's going to take me into more of something probably very metaphysical, something very considerable. The novel needs to be its own answer. And built into that will be the sense of the cosmic, the sense of the problem of time, of being a human being for such a short window. And yet there is this world around us that is unanswerable. And, you know, as an atheist, the problem of human meaning is fundamental here. So what you're talking about is, how do we define ourselves as human beings in a world that cannot know us? And so we're always surrounded by moments of time that remind us that our time is passing. My novels are full of these glimpses from all sorts of different places. They may come from the land or from people or from memory, but they're glimpses of the fragility of life, the shortness of time, you know, what the Japanese call mono no aware, that passing moment. And at the same time, just that grand indifference. Because I'm interested in the problem of meaning. How do we define ourselves within life? How do we give meaning to our suffering? Because if we can't give meaning to the problem of suffering, then it's all over. We can't continue. So how do we define ourselves? How do we endure all of these ancient problems that go back to the Greeks? I'm trying to put modern flesh on them, you know, these metaphysical problems of what does it mean to be a human being? How much human being is in a human being? And how do we arrive at a sense of dignity as people, especially when we're being met with the unwanted, the unknown, when we're being met with the worst, when we're being met with the absolute threat to our lives? How do we define ourselves in a world that doesn't want to know us? And so this kind of writing perhaps requires a full scalability. It requires maximal sense of the intimate and the universal, the local and the cosmic.
The main character of Paul Lynch's Prophet Song, Eiler Stack, is a scientist and mother of four who must contend with the fragmentation of her life and family in a totalitarian Ireland. The novel unravels in dense, run-on paragraphs with only spare punctuation and paragraph breaks. And confronting this kind of pressurized language gives the sense of falling asleep outside when it is daylight and jolting awake to an ink dark only interrupted by cold stars. It's the sensation of a claustrophobic freefall, the sensation of coming up against, as Lynch says, the cosmic worlds beyond this world that cannot know us, but can easily devastate us. In Lynch's novels, social and ecological wildernesses feel equally consuming. In Prophet Song, Eilish watches her known political landscape, the liberal democratic ideals of transparent communication and open speech, devolve into a wasteland that does not hear or know the individual. Barely intelligible wasteland. I'm extremely interested in this bare intelligibility of the enormous forces that surround Lynch's characters, particularly in a world where the apparently intelligible principles of liberal democracy are indeed under threat. It seems that to survive requires us to rethink the manners of speaking, and perhaps more crucially, of listening, which we have been calling politics. At times, we can't even listen to those who speak our own language. But at the very least, it seems that when we human citizens listen, we expect to hear speech. But not everything affected by our politics speaks, or speaks our language. The sea, the dumps, the insect feeding on dumps, the birds, air, earth, the chemical dust, the sediments, and will not move. Those are the vast tribe of the cosmic that we live with and inside. So have we formed a kind of democracy that is not prepared to listen to how these tribes speak? Because their speech seems vague, quiet, far away, or because it requires interpretation. And if our politics is not prepared to listen to those forces, are we prepared then, or have we ever been prepared, to hear its utter indifference? To hear the wind sound of ecological collapse that we might imagine we are somehow sheltered from, insulated as we are in our own human language? Paul Lynch's writing reminds us that this second kind of listening is also a quotidian and very individual one. It spins out from one person, one character, one personal question. From one's personal language, because I believe that each of us has a personal language, how we think and write and talk to ourselves that, to an extent, only we understand. Lynch shows us that there is a vast indifference that surrounds this individual language and the personal life it allows us to understand. That cosmic indifference maybe doesn't speak, but it has a sound or song we can hear. The question is, then, how we give meaning to that sound and how we write towards it. And now, back to the interview.
Yeah, thank you. I guess I'm also asking these questions because as a young writer, I am trying to write about a particular history that took place a few hundred years ago, and I'm trying to work through all of these archival materials and place my life in relation to the honestly rather indifferent to me historical lives of others. And it's not quite cosmic, but I'm definitely feeling, as you say, the sense of trying to find my shape within the indifference of this historical architecture that has come before me. But this is proving to be very difficult because history, not even cosmic history, just like this 100-year span I'm trying to write about, feels so enormous and so rigid. Specifically my research, like everything I read seems like events that happened in all caps. And it just feels impossible to get inside with a vehicle that's as, I guess, fluid as poetry or maybe fiction, because once I isolate a moment, I just know that I'm lying. That moment is not alone. It's inflected by what comes before and what comes after. And then so I feel like I'm beholden to context and I have to give more and more context. And my poetry just becomes context and it's possible to even find my so-called voice within it. So in a more grounded sense, I was wondering if you could speak to your relationship with your historical research, how you go about your research, how that has changed over the years, because I know that your novels, some of them are historical, like your novel Grace. And I was wondering what that research practice means to you.
What you're describing, I would diagnose what you're saying as a problem that's been over-intellectualized. And, you know, as a writer, I come at it from the other side. There's a quote from Ingmar Bergman, the great film director, that's very, very important to me because he articulates precisely what it is you're supposed to do as a writer. He says that intuition is the spear you throw into the dark. Intellect is the army you send in afterwards. And so writing has to come from the place of intuition. It has to come from the place of authenticity. You know, I'm a big believer in what the Greeks called the daemonic, that sense of the Greeks believed that creativity was not something within you, it was external to you, that when you were creative, your personal daemon was in communication with the gods. That was the channel through which inspiration came. But of course, we know that's an internal process. And your daemonic is something that when you enter into deepest flow, you move past the intellect. You move entirely into the intuitive sphere. And you're writing from a place that's not intellectual. You're writing from a place that is, you know, it's hard to describe this. I'm a meditator, but it's a higher mind. It's a higher level of consciousness. It's a sense of self that sits outside time. It's a sense of self that has a fuller sense of what it is it wants to express or explore. And I write from this place. And for me, research only comes in later. Research is something that I do to add physics to the universe that I'm writing. But for me, writing begins first and foremost with problems of the spirit, problems of the person, problems of being alive, of being in the world. And I move forward from that place. It's always intuitive. There's always some kind of problem that I need to resolve. I bring the intellect in afterwards. I mean, I always know exactly what I'm doing. I know the ideas I'm chasing, the ideas that are under the line, so to speak. But the fundamental driver is the intuitive self. And so it's really important not to intellectualize your writing. It's really important not to overthink it, not to, you know, subject it to academic thought, because you're just going to hobble yourself. It has to come from the other side, the dark side of your mind. It has to come from the place of unthought. And meditation is one of the great ways to get to that place. or any kind of practice that gets you up into that space where flow or the demonic can be accessed. So, you know, I do research. Prophet Song required a lot of research. All my books require research, but the research is not important. It's just there as the stuffing, so to speak. It's there to add structure and a sense of believability or reality to the tale.
I think that that's so true. I think that that's very sound advice. You mentioned in this conversation, Ingmar Bergman, you mentioned film. And for those who don't know, you were a number of years a film critic for the Sunday Tribune. So I'm just wondering, you know, to helping you get to that place of intuition, of not explaining things, but just experiencing them in the present moment. How do you feel all those years being immersed in thinking and writing about film? How do you feel that gave you that sense of momentum and those other things that move beyond logic to this living imaginative world?
It was a great privilege to be a film critic because I was a cinephile. And I suppose the dream when you're a serious movie buff is to get to write about the cinema. And that happened. I ended up being the chief film critic for the Sunday Tribune in Dublin, which is a newspaper that doesn't exist anymore, but it was a very serious broadsheet center-left paper. And so it was a really cool thing to do. And I reviewed over 1,000 films in that time, and many of them essay length. And I suppose I learned something very fundamental, which is that even the most fractured art house film is still fundamentally telling a story. The story is inescapable. It really is fundamental to what we are as human beings. And I think this is backed up by modern neuroscience. You know, when you think about how we view the world, there's data around us all the time. And we see A and we see C and we infer B. We're constantly narrating reality to ourselves. We narrate the story of our lives to ourselves. We narrate it in linear fashion. And I know many writers have played with time in all sorts of amazing ways, but we're storytellers. This is what we do. And if you give the brain a story, a pre-packaged story, you're giving a cheesecake. That's what it wants. That's why it loves stories. That's why our society is just built on stories. Politics is nothing but stories. Everything we do in the evenings, we sit down, we're watching Netflix, just stories. We consume them all the time. We're just belief machines for belief. And so this is what I learned. And so I take the idea of storytelling, I take the art of storytelling very seriously. I think that to tell a story really well requires great skill. And I think that the greatest storytellers, what they do is take us up to the mythic. The best stories are myths. And that's the most difficult thing to do in the world. And so when I hear writers say, I'm not interested in narrative, I'm not interested in story, I have no interest in what they're talking about. I think that they're spoofers usually. I think that because it's actually the hardest thing to do. But the goal, of course, is to put your ideas, what you're chasing intellectually, under the line. You don't put it on top. You're not dictating to the reader what your ideas are. You have to demonstrate your ideas. And so that's something else I learned from cinema, is to demonstrate and not to tell, not to be, you know, constantly harassing the reader or cajoling them or instructing them. It's just quietly demonstrate your ideas, and the people who are interested in the ideas will absorb them, and those who will miss them will get the story. And that's the goal.
Yeah. And I think you said there we're storytelling machines, and now we're at a new frontier where there actually are storytelling machines, and this is threatening us as artists. And then you also mentioned that your newspaper is no longer a newspaper. We've seen this, and it's not, rather it's the rise of AI, which is only accelerating the demise of local newspapers and, you know, our ability to have healthy democracies. These are things that we need to keep alive, I believe. Human storytelling, and then human storytelling in the form of journalism, which is very, very important, so we don't have the rise of fascism. So I'm just wondering what your reflections are on the future of journalism, and then the future of storytelling by humans to humans, and why that's so important.
Well, the future of journalism is really dependent on the future of our politics. So if the politics continues to shift into the authoritarian, then there's no future of journalism. It's that simple. As regards, you know, storytelling, AI in itself at this moment in time is not all evil. It does some very interesting, useful things. But I deeply disagree with, I actually not just disagree, I abhor the fact that thousands of writers have had their work just fed into the machine without their permission. I think it's outrageous. It's a disgrace to feed the learning capacities of AI. But, you know, do I fear for storytelling? I don't think so, because I spoke about the demonic earlier on, which is the authentic self. The demonic comes from a lived life. It comes from the pain of experience. It comes from all that truly makes up a person. And AI can seek to manipulate it, but there's something just incredibly unique in the way words are expressed by a human being, with all the imprint of a life in the choice of words, the imprint of a life in the sentences, that expression of feeling that comes from the authentic self, that sense of somebody who's lived in the world, who understands suffering or pain or whatever it is that makes a person a person. And when you transmit that into the words, and when you're somebody who's a genuine artist, a genuine voice on the page, it's incredibly unique and it's incredibly difficult to recreate artificially. And so for sure, AI is going to get to a point where it's probably going to script your low-rent Hollywood thrillers for us. And it might do well better than what we've been getting for the last 20 years, frankly. But in terms of art, I'm not that worried. Art, I think, will endure. I just don't know if our society will endure the whole lot of marble.
And whether the earth, and just to bring it back, just in closing, you talked about stories inspired by the land, so many of your stories having this sense of longing for the sea and what lies beyond. And someone who grew up in this very rural, remote region, and, you know, what your reflections are on the beauty and wonder of the natural world and how it may continue to inspire you in your writing.
You know, there was the time of the Romantic poets when you would go out into the world and you would seek a landscape of great emptiness and beauty, and you would encounter the sublime, you would encounter the sense of the vast terror and unknown of being in the world. But you'd also meet a mirror to yourself. You could encounter a silence with which you could actually hear your own authentic self speak, that small, quiet voice within. So I think that's pretty much gone. It's very difficult to experience that anymore. It's impossible. Most people are never going to go for a walk in the mountains without the phone for a start. So it's extremely difficult to experience that. But in Beyond the Sea, my fourth novel, there's this grim irony where they're at sea adrift in the Pacific for months and months at a time. And this idea of 19th century pastoral, pristine universe, it just doesn't exist anymore, because what they're living off is the detritus and filth and refuse of human beings floating in the ocean. So even the vast expanse of the ocean is completely corrupted by human beings. So there's nowhere left at this point to truly experience this. I mean, I'm probably exaggerating to some extent, but I'm an artist, so that's what I'm going to do. But I think if you want to have experienced that sense of the authentic self that is always there, you're going to have to work at it a lot harder now.
Yeah, but that's true. That's why we do have to work at it, you know, individually and collectively. So thank you, Paul Lynch, for sharing your compassionate cosmic storytelling and shining that light on those dark moments in the human experience so that we may understand the importance of stories and find the poetry in paths to resilience. Thank you for adding your voice to the creative process.
All my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
The Creative Process podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk and Henny Zhang with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interview producers on this episode were Katie Foster and Henny Zhang. The Creative Process is produced by Mia Funk, with additional production support by Sophie Garnier. Wintertime was composed by Nicholas Anadolis and performed by the Athenian Trio. We hope you enjoyed listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just follow us on Instagram @creativeprocesspodcast and send us a DM. Thanks for listening.